This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found on Gadget Geek show number 326, recorded on September 14th, 2017. Here on Home Gadget Geeks, we cover all the favorite tech gadgets that find their way into your home, news, reviews, product updates, and conversation, all for the average tech guy. I'm your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios in a very warm AverageGuy.tv studios where there's like these Indian summers, Nathaniel, that go on, right, yeah. Where it hangs on. Man, summer in the Midwest. I know it's raining in the South, and Houston and Florida have gotten hammered, but it's been dry and warm. You guys are warm up there?
Yeah, it's been in the upper 80s, and they're talking about 90s coming soon. But dry. Yeah,
I think maybe it's the last. This might be the last gasp of summer here in the Midwest. I sure hope so. I'm ready for fall. I don't know about you. I went out tonight. My flowers were kind of wilted over. Hadn't got enough water on them. We haven't had rain, I think, in about 3 or 4 weeks.
Right.
We could use it. So anyways, we'll post the show notes, world-class show notes. And they're really good this week because Nathaniel wrote really awesome notes that are out there. And of course, we post them out at theaverageguy.tv. Don't forget, and I have some new news on our mobile apps. So Android wasn't working for a while, and I didn't even realize it. Spreaker had contacted me and said, hey, Jim, you need to do some new things and create a developer account. And then I had to submit it to Google, and then they rejected it. And then I had to say, no, I own the AverageGuy.tv. And then they said, okay. So they have reapproved the Android app. So if you haven't gone out to the Average Guy, if you haven't gone out to HomeGadgetGeeks.com, that is our mobile site, and you can do it from your phone, and you have access to either the iPhone app or the Android app. It's available. It is working. Someone contacted me, and I couldn't find the email. I always feel bad when I do that. So if you're listening to the show and you contacted me and you said, hey, it's not working, one, thank you for doing that. I always appreciate it when you guys let me know things are messed up. I never get mad. It's always great. So let me know, and things aren't working the way they are, but we've got it fixed. So HomeGadgetGeeks.com. Best way to listen to it on the road, mobile. It's just a great little app. It does what it does. LastPass sponsors that. LastPass is coming on early November now. I've got Amber confirmed on that. We appreciate their sponsorship of that app. Both Android and iPhone work, and we appreciate LastPass for their sponsorship. I mentioned Patreon in the pre-show, and the best way to get speaking of the pre-show, we had a pretty interesting conversation in our pre-show. If you want to get access to the video of the pre and the video of the post or audio of those, we make those available now for as little as a $1 a month pledge on Patreon. And if you head out to theaverageguy.tv, click on the Patreon link, that'll get you there as well. We appreciate your sponsorship of the show. And don't forget, I got asked this a couple times too. We have video RSS feeds. I don't know if everybody knew that. If you wanted to download the video to your phone, an hour is about 200 meg and small, and it's about 400 to 500 meg on large. That's a lot of space, so you don't want to keep too many of those. But those are available for you in RSS. They'll download automatically, just like the audio. And I don't know why you'd want them, but people do. I get 100 of you to download them, both small and medium, or small and large, every single month or every single show. It's crazy. So if you want to do that, those feeds are available in our subscribe links. Go out to theaverageguy.tv/subscribe. One more reminder, Home Server Show Meetup is coming up September 29th. Chances are it's maybe too late for you at this point, but I will mention it. Dave McCabe out there in Indianapolis, and I'll have a link in the show notes to it. It's still not too late. You can still make it. I think it's $20 and you show up. Dave always has awesome food, and there's some awesome giveaways and usually awesome people that are there. Nathaniel said he's not making it, so we'll be minus one awesome person.
I'm sorry.
That is there. No, it's okay. You're doing some camping that weekend. So we appreciate you guys coming out to the meetup. Link to it is out there. I look forward to this. This is the last meetup we'll do in Indianapolis. Dave's trying to hand this thing off to me. I'm not sure we're going to do it in Omaha. Yeah, it would be.
That's a great idea.
I know. I got an email from a listener, a couple weeks ago. We started the newsletter again. It's weekly now. So if you haven't subscribed to the newsletter, you want to go out there. I kind of give some updates on what's going on, plus the next four guests that are coming up. Said, I love the newsletter, Jim. I haven't seen the Omaha meetup yet happen yet. And so that was a little hint, like, when is the Omaha meetup going to happen? So, all right, maybe next year, maybe next fall, we'll be able to kick. Nathaniel, when's a good time? Like, we've always done Home Server Show in the fall. Is that a good, do you think that's a good time as opposed to summer for that?
Yeah, I think end of September, early October is good. things settle down from the start of the school year for those who have school age obligations.
Yeah. Well, and they're not easy to do. I mean, I've watched Dave. This guy, Dave, has crushed this for 6 or 7 years now. I think 2011 was our first one. And so he does an amazing job on these. And I have tons of respect for him, but they are super fun. It was great to meet you in person there. And there's Brian Auer and Kevin Schoonover and the whole crew. Many of you come out. I can't name everybody, but I think I've talked to Dwayne into coming back. So Dwayne Robinson will be back. I hope he was on the show a couple weeks ago. So yeah, Mike Howard says 15-hour drive for him. It'd be even longer, Mike, if he tried to come to Omaha. Ken says plus one on a centralized meetup. Omaha is a little more centralized, and in the airport, we have 20 gates maybe, and it's just two ends. And I literally show up at the airport 45 minutes before a flight, and I'm waiting 20 minutes to get on it. So it's super easy to get in and get through. I think you guys would like Omaha. Maybe I can figure out a way to get it done. So if you're going to join us on the 29th, you need to act now, Home Service Show Meetup. And we would look forward to seeing you there. It's not too late to join. All right, Nathaniel, welcome back. Good to have you here. You've been busy a little bit. For folks, there may be some new folks that are listening. Give us just a little bit of your background. What do you do? Where do you work? Some of those kinds of
things. Sure. Well, I work for a medium, small school district here in Minnesota, a suburb of Minneapolis, and we have about 8,400 students, 1,000 staff, and I work in the IT department, so Department of Media and Technology Services, and I manage a team of about 20-some people, both in the buildings and at the district, keeping the lights on and keeping things running, and it's been a busy year.
Super easy job, right? Nothing ever goes wrong, construction always on time, those kinds of things?
No. We deal in problems. So it's you have to remind yourself, like, there's a lot of things that are really working, and instead of focusing on all the things that have to be corrected or set up or fixed. And this summer, the district did a big capital improvement campaign at 7 out of 9 buildings. And that presented some challenges to us at the end of August and early September, as the contractors fell a little bit behind schedule, and there was quite a rush to get things set up. But I had a good team that was really working hard, and they really wanted things to go well. So we had people staying late. We came in on the weekend of Labor Day. There was a lot of extra work put in to try to get things closer to being ready. So it's starting to settle down now, and it's good. It's improvement. It's working forward, but it's a lot of work packed into a short time.
Yeah, and a lot of moving parts with teachers and technology. You and I were talking about smart boards. Yep. And the promise of smart boards has always been, oh, this is going to be so great. And then nobody ever uses them. You know, the demos look great. The world's best demo is a smart board demo. Like, they've got this figured out. But you have to go to training for like a month to know all the, got to hold your hand right and tap on your head while you rub your tummy to make those things work. Right. I mean, do you see that where they get new technology in and there's kind of the promises of it and it just
doesn't
come to fruition?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that sound good and you get it in and a few years later you realize it's not quite what you thought. But whatever it is, there's always like a bell curve, you know. There's teachers who really incorporate it, learn how to use it, and just do an excellent job taking advantage of the tools they have. And then there's a bulk that use it a little bit or, you know, some, but not, could get by without it. And then there's some that have no idea that it's even there. So you get that curve. What we try to do as we can, thinking ahead, is plan for what can we put in a space that's going to be compatible down the road in terms of usability. If it's a special ed type environment, it needs some things, but can we make it work with just general ed? Because a lot of the schools, everyone's short on space, so they'll switch out rooms. That was an office, now it's a small learning space. Or if it was a large classroom, now it's split into two. Or they're always shifting around the use of spaces. And it was a fifth grade room, so the board was up higher, but now it's a kindergarten room, so you got to lower the board. Or so there's things like that that we're trying to think, what can we do ahead to anticipate those changes?
Yeah. Why does it always seem like schools are out of space? That, you know, I hear that like we're jammed.
I know.
Easter famine, right?
Yeah, some schools have had additions added like every summer. So yeah. They're like, well, what's going on?
High growth area is the neighborhoods. Is there a lot of growth going on in your neighborhood, or just a lot of young people?
We're pretty stable. I mean, enrollment is controlled in terms of we can open up more open enrollment kids outside of the city and district that can come in to kind of balance up if there's a dip in the district people that live, students that live in the district. So we can kind of control that. But it does always seem like you could use more space, more space. And
our kids went to a school that was built in the 30s and they were just smaller people, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's one of those, that's like a home built in the 50s. The closets aren't big enough, right? They just didn't have as many clothes as
right.
We did
today. Yeah.
We just have so much stuff, you know, yep. And so you guys got to pack some technology. Nathaniel, over the last couple of years, you've really become kind of our Chromebook guy. I don't know how that's happened, but it has. You're kind of our Chromebook guy. We bring you on. It seems like once in the spring, once in the fall to kind of talk about how things are going. It's a new year. Did you guys roll out new equipment, and what have you guys been looking at from a Chromebook standpoint?
Right. So we're a big Chromebook district, 6 through 12. All the students have a device. So some students bring from home and they want to use a MacBook or they want to use Windows. We're trying to be flexible in the sense that students can pick the device they need. Our requirement, it has to run the Chrome browser. So we have some students that will bring iPads and run Chrome, but it's on them to figure out the workarounds and make it happen. But the Chromebook has been good for us in the sense that it's a lower cost price point device. It's incredibly easy to deploy and troubleshoot. And other than it being a cheaper priced laptop, it's, you have repair issues, but it's been a good device. It's compatible with Google Apps, which we use a lot. So this year we didn't do a big buy of Chromebooks because we're kind of stable and we're pausing a year on device deployment. We're covered where we need to be, but we wanted to put more money into infrastructure and AV. So we upgraded a lot of projectors, wireless, and those kind of things that are in the background. But the Chromebooks we have been playing with last year and we're deploying more this year are the touch-based Chromebooks that can support Android apps. And so I've been playing with a couple of those from Acer that we've been looking at. And this one here is the Acer R13, which is fortunately silver. So it looks like a MacBook and that's appealing to people.
It's intentional, right?
But it's a 13-inch screen and it's a 1080p. So it's got the high resolution touchscreen and it's very light, just a little over 3 pounds. And it is an Android supporting model. So you can flip it into a tablet mode back on itself and then just use the screen and a pop-up keyboard on that. And it's fast. It's a good, quick machine. It's, running Chrome OS. And
what's the retail on those? $300-$400? Is that about right?
Yeah, I think I should know that. I think they're $479.
Yeah, I was going through. I think that in that model, it's say in the fours somewhere probably.
Yeah. I should know that, right? Let's see, Amazon.
No, you didn't pay for them. You the school district picked
but
them.
But I'm very conscious.
Yeah, I know. It's do you think
$380? It's about $400. But
and do you think that's the sweet spot for these Chromebooks, to be honest? If you go too cheap, they
no.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, so our this is a high end device from our point of view. So then as a district, we have to buy a management license to go with it, which is $25 for the life of the device so that we can manage it with the Google control panel. And then we actually have switched to paying for a third-party repair company rather than we've been doing self-service repair for a while and it just got to be too much. And then what happens is we invested in a model and it was great, but then the repairs started increasing as the life of the device decreased. And so then it was harder to get parts. The parts that we could get got more expensive over time.
Right.
So, and that makes sense because if they discontinue a model, they're not going to keep making parts and the vendor's not going to want to, keep them alive. So we've been using a third party repair service that kind of guarantees it for 3 years and they'll fix anything, multiple times. You just ship it out, wait a while, it comes back. And especially in that middle school years, we tend to see more repair requests than later in high school.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just a natural conclusion to length of time, you know, divided by abuse times what the parts are made for, you know, yeah. length. And so there's got to be some economies, I guess, for these companies then that are servicing these where they're servicing it for
oh,
you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, and they'll buy a big stock of 200 just to have to demolish for parts. And then they'll buy them back from us at some point. If we want to sell, you know, if we want to get rid of a line, they'll say, oh, we'll buy all those. And they'll just, you know, give us a credit, then stock them and do that. What we've been using more for the students is a smaller model of Acer called the R11, which is very similar, but it's more of a black, plastic case, but it still flips back. It still does the touch. It's basically the same except for a lower resolution screen, a little bit different processor, but it's a little more durable. It's got more heft to it. And what we're trying to do is see with the addition of Android apps, does it make it a two-in-one device where the teachers will say, well, I need an iPad because it has the touch screen and it has this app ecosystem that's so robust. And well, if we can provide a Chromebook that can do both, that might be real beneficial.
Are you finding that that model is doing better than the other, or is that too early in the mix?
Well, the R11, the smaller one, we use with students more. Yeah. And the R13 is really to kind of encourage our teachers to try using a Chromebook as their main device rather than a Windows laptop. Because honestly, we can take a teacher that has a broken Windows laptop and we get them a new one and get them set up. And that's, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes to get files copied and get them set up, get their settings all done. And with a Chromebook, whether it's a student or a teacher, we can swap it out in 5 minutes. It's basically, can you sign in? Okay, see you later. You know, because everything's copied up to Google, the settings all transfer, you know. It's just a quick turnover from our point of view. It's a selfish IT guy thing. This is less work for me.
Yeah. Well, you've purchased the infrastructure to be able to support it, right? That's just that comes along with it. Do you find, you mentioned the app ecosystem for Apple, right?
Yeah.
In the Chrome world, has it gotten better? Is that still legitimate? You know, we hear this all the time on the Windows side. I mean, there's really very few apps on the Windows side that are worth anything, but On the Android side, are the apps there? Is it available? Is it working for them?
Yeah, there's some. So what happens is your Chromebook will reach a point where Google blesses it to run Android apps, and there's a list of supported Chromebooks, and the R11 was a newer one. And then what you do, which is nice for us, is it's a approved list only. So nobody in our domain gets to install an Android app unless we pre-approve it for the domain. So they can't just get whatever they want, which is different from the Chrome Web Store. Right now we allow the Chrome Web Store wide open. And, you know, generally, you know, once in a while, there'll be an app that causes a problem for a user that we got to help remove. But the Android apps, I haven't noticed a huge difference. So I'm looking for apps that are more friendly for touch and you'd want to use on a tablet versus why not just run it in Chrome. And, you know, so ones like, Google Earth is pretty sweet because it really takes advantage of the 10-point touchscreen and being able to turn and zoom in and out. That works quite well. And then there's many, many sketch drawing apps where you can do painting or drawing or layers. You know, Adobe has a whole suite of Android apps that you can use for free with an Adobe account. And then, of course, if you want storage and features, it's a bit of an upgrade. But they're good. Autodesk makes really good apps. They have a sketch one that you can use a stylus or a finger and start drawing and do layers. Someone mentioned earlier that the Samsung Pro looks really good. That's one that comes with a stylus. And I like that one, but I didn't feel comfortable with schools with that because it looks lighter weight, flimsier. And it didn't have HDMI out, if I remember. So one of the things I looked at in models is full HDMI output rather than USB-C, then an adapter. And we have so many dongles and adapters to fit all the models of laptops and that people want that we're really hoping we can get full HDMI out on more devices, and then we can not have to carry around a kit of six different adapters depending on what you have.
Yeah, that is kind of nice. I carry that for work because I never know. You know, I never know. Yeah, I might be at a college one day. I might be in somebody's boardroom the next day, whatever, right? So you got to have everything to kind of, they'll always ask me, so are you an Apple guy or so are you a Windows guy? Or, you know, I carry them all. So,
well, it depends. Like a Surface Pro would have one output and a MacBook would have a different. And so the new Chromebooks are coming. Google's kind of said, we want all the Chromebooks to be USB-C charging. So they're slowly getting that into line. So this one's USB-C, but the R11's just a standard plug. So that'll be nice when it's standardized across Chromebooks.
And Windows devices too, by the way.
Yeah, great. Yeah. And I wish my iPhone was USB-C.
Right.
But yeah.
Although we'll talk about that a little bit later, right? That's going a different direction.
Yeah. Yep. But, you know, it's going to standardize, but we've got a mix in our buildings of projectors that use VGA input still and projectors that are HDMI only. So if we have a substitute come in, we give them a laptop or a Chromebook that has two adapters. Well, if you're in this room, you might need HDMI. And if you're over here, you might need VGA. And it's just a transition period.
Do you find that those substitutes come up to speed pretty quick? You know, you bring them in, you issue them some equipment, and or are they just kind of like, look, I just got to keep the kids occupied for a day. I'm not going to use the technology. What do you find?
It's tough. So the subs we get that come back and, you know, our return, they get up to speed. They know what they're doing. They're familiar. And the ones that don't, it takes them a little longer. And we try to help them, but we can't spend an hour in the building every morning making sure that the six subs at the high school get comfortable and figure out what they're going to do. You know, we try to help them, but there's a lot of other stuff. But the ones who are around more get the hang of things. But the teachers expect them to be able to be proficient because their lesson plans depend on the kids using devices and digital lessons or videos or, you know, work that's in the digital world. So if a sub comes in and like, I can't log in, I can't use a computer, you know, it makes it really hard for the teacher to keep the lesson plans and the curriculum going. So, and then what do they do if they make a PowerPoint, how do they get it shared with the sub? And there's all that rights issues of who can see what. And we use a learning management system called Schoology, which is like a Moodle product or, you know, those LMSs. And so a lot of times what they'll do is they'll have the student log into the Schoology course, and they're all the materials the teacher's already laid out. So the sub doesn't have to have rights to get to it. They, you know, the student can project the same stuff as they see it.
They could leave a lesson plan that it could be executed. Okay, I need you guys to log in. The entire thing is here. I'm going to look over your shoulder while you go do it. They don't necessarily have to walk them through it. How are you finding that, you know, the it was always with multiple, you know, with Google, you can, like, I have seven Google accounts of some kind. And so I'm assuming in the school district, because you guys are a Google school, you have some, you have some email address, or how are you guys setting that up? So do teachers have, can they bring their own email address in? Do you guys issue them one? How does that work?
For the students or the teachers?
Yeah, for teachers, both. Well, yeah, for both.
Yeah, so all the students are issued a Gmail account, a Google Apps account that we own and manage. And one of the nice things about the Google for Education system, or G Suite for Education, is that you have to change your mindset of managing the account more than managing the device. So when they log into a system with that account has policies and restrictions and benefits. So if it's a personal device and they're logging into Chrome with their school account, they get the settings that we want per account. If they have a personal device and they log into their Gmail, we don't touch it. It's their business. So it's really nice being moving a little more account-centric rather than device-centric. So we have some policies we apply per device to devices we own, but we can't apply those same policies to a personal device, which I think is a real benefit, whether it's a staff or a student. It's the account that we own and care about. So it works well that way. And we get some conflict. A lot of times teachers or students will be signed in their personal Gmail account, and then they'll click a link and it says, you don't have permission for this. And they're like, what? It's me. And we have to explain, well, it is, but it isn't. And
right. Yeah, that can be difficult to use. Sometimes you have to completely sign out. I mean, you get it completely signed out. You try to use switch accounts. Google Docs is really bad about this. You switch accounts, and then it still will not let you in.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard.
Yeah, you didn't completely sign out of the other one. I have three at work that I use for various, you know, for various things. And I switch in between them all the time. And I get that situation around, okay, log out, completely log out, log back in, get the right account, get access to those. Do you find, so do the substitutes have, are there like, do they have accounts for the, in the system there as well? Or do you have to create one when they get there?
No, no. When they come in and they get entered in an HR system, even as a substitute, then it automatically generates Active Directory, which then generates Google. So we try to create accounts for subs. Sometimes they don't know they have it yet, but we try to create accounts for them in our system so they can get the same access as the teachers. And what I always tell people with the multiple accounts, I'm like, use Safari for your Gmail account and use Chrome for your school account, you know, or use Firefox in this. Keep the browsers separate and then you won't run into this problem.
Yeah. And if you use that Ghost browser, I'll do a callback to a show we did back in the spring. So we had the Ghost browser and that actually in the browser separate. You can separate the accounts in the browser and then kind of, you know, cordon them off from each other. So you can still have one browser open and have multiple accounts in there. So it's pretty cool. It's mostly for testing reasons, but that would work pretty well kind of in this scenario. Any other apps that you're finding particularly useful or helpful on there? You mentioned Plex.
Yeah, I like the, I'm a big Plex fan, like a lot of us, and the Plex app on Android running on the Chromebook works really well. So this is a 1080p laptop. So I just fire up the movie. It's in full resolution, you know, streams for a couple hours. I don't, you know, the battery life on this is a full day. So that's one of the selling points for the staff is like, you just charge this at night and then you use it all day. You don't have to carry your charger around from classroom to classroom or building to building. And the Plex app works really nicely. WhatsApp doesn't work, unfortunately. That's one I like to use because I can use it on desktop or on phone, but it doesn't work.
Nah, don't worry about it.
I don't know. But WhatsApp isn't written. So it's an Android app, but it hasn't been written to be ported to Chrome.
Right.
So you run into that occasionally.
You find the kids are using WhatsApp quite a bit?
Yeah, I use it with my staff and the interns that we have over the summer.
Yeah.
And it's mostly because they have a mix of Android and iPhone. And so it's much easier to do groups and texting. And we'd get into the building where we don't have a cell signal at all. So we'd have to go via Wi-Fi. And so if you're relying on SMS messaging of cellular data, it doesn't work. So It's been really helpful for us as we deploy and come back and try to communicate pictures. This is what I saw. What's this? You know, it's been a good tool for us.
Yeah. You guys have been doing this for a while now. Do you see a difference between the students today and the students? How long have you been using Chromebooks? 5 years? 4 or 5 years?
Five, six.
It's crazy how fast that goes, right?
Yeah. I'd have to look.
Do you see a difference or do you sense a difference in the students now using these versus what it was 5 years ago and you were initially introducing them? Meaning, you know, do the kids adopt them faster? Do they, you know, did you notice any difference in the students?
Yeah, I think they slowly get more used to it. It's always a shock. So in the elementary K-5 and grades 3 through 5, we have a cart of Chromebooks in the classroom and it stays in the room. So those kids are using it, you know, not every day, but frequently, and they're getting used to the login and the routines of how do I learn with a device without being absorbed by the device. So then in sixth grade, they hit the middle school, and now all of a sudden this device is theirs to take back and forth to school. And so there's a lot of, you know, how do you care and feed for your Chromebook and take care of it? And some kids learn it better than others. But it's been around so long that I think the teachers are more comfortable with routines and they're doing that. And the hardest thing, I think, and maybe the teachers feel differently, is getting kids to check their email. Like,
I have a hard time getting my college students to check their email.
Yeah. And I keep trying to say, like, this is what we do in work. We don't text each other, you know, information all the time.
Yeah. But it's different. It's the weirdest thing. when we just got through onboarding and having, you know, we do a parent student orientation for our high school internship program for Gallup. And Jody, my partner at work, says to the students, she's the heavy hand in what we do. She's,
oh, good.
You know, and she says, you guys have to check your email. Like, I know you don't, but you have to check your email. That's just the way, that's the way it works. The things we need to do and the information we need to get to you and attachments and stuff, it has to be done via email. That's the system we have in place. And I had to set minimum requirements for any college students staying on for the fall. I said, I need you checking your email daily. Like, that has to be a,
They were probably looking at you like, what? Like, every day?
I know. Yeah. You're like, every day. You check your Facebook every day, right? Check your email every day and put it on your phone or whatever. But it's just so different, you know.
Yep.
There's no social rewards for email, right? There's no there's no pictures. It's just text. And
well, at the same time, work. Yeah, we often complain about email. I mean, I always say, boy, I could do email or I can do work. Like, do you want me to work on things or do you want me to do email? And it's hard balancing it. You're familiar with that. And so it's kind of like, we know what this evil is, but it's a necessary evil. And it's still the standard of communication. It's accountability. It's how you share lots of information at once. I'm not going to text out instructions to you. And then, you know, but then as much as I struggle with the volume of email, I don't know where I heard it, but someone said email is for the convenience of the sender. And I thought, yes, that's why.
Yeah. I was just doing a webcast today at work, and the gentleman we were interviewing was like, he says, I'm a reply all buster. Like, it's my job. When I see emails with reply all, I break them. Yeah. That is not, it's just, he is not a big fan of, you know, and that's real common, right? You know, you put 8 or 9 people and then 10 more get added, and then it's reply all. Right. And you have, I am lucky at Gallup. I don't get too many of those kinds of emails, but it is, I oftentimes say our email system is broken, and I don't mean at Gallup. I mean in general.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty broken, but I'll spend 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes a day. It's part of my job is to just get through communication that way. I still prefer to get people face to face. So oftentimes if I want to talk to them, I'll walk over to their desk, even though it's a 5-minute walk, I'll walk over to their desk first to see if they're there rather than send them an email. Because I just think face to face is so important. Nathaniel, every time I have you on, I say to myself, you know, I should just have a Chromebook here in the studios so that I can kind of, you know, I have an extra Android phone, even though I'm on iPhone, right? I've got an Amazon Echo. You know, I've got a couple. I said the wake word. Now she's ready to say something.
NPR reports.
Uh-oh. There you go.
Of the Air National Guard, Lauren Durham, and Michael Davis.
No, turn that down. Okay. So somehow I...
the pair got married in a hangar instead of...
Wow, there she goes.
Echo, stop. There we go. Okay. I tried turning her down and she turned herself back up. It's like, hey, stop. Anyways, I have all this extra equipment around here. One thing I've never really worked with is a Chromebook. Is that something, if I'm a tech enthusiast, is that something I should have or have on my desk? Is what would be the value for me to have it over having something else on there? Is it worth having having that around just for technology's sake?
I would say it's great for my kids. My boys use it for schoolwork and watching YouTube and things. And it's great for on the couch. I want to browse stuff. You could do Facebook and Google and all these things where you want more than just your phone screen. So I've got iPads and, you know, they're fine. I never think I'm going to go get my iPad to go look something up. So for me, it's like, I'm going to use the iPad to watch Netflix or Amazon or play a game or, you know, something. But if it's, I'm looking something up or I'm reading articles, a Chromebook's good for that. It's a good couch type thing. Or it's also fits well for someone who doesn't want to do computer maintenance. And I just want to turn it on, log in and have everything there and then have it restart and it still works. And, that's a good device. So it's a good like mother-in-law device in some ways. And, it's very simple. And, you know, there's not a lot to troubleshoot. You power it off, you restart it, you can wipe it, which is a kind of a fresh install off of Chrome, but it's cloud-based. So, and it's secure. There's not the viruses and.
Yeah. Maybe that's my mom's next computer, to be honest. You know, we got her on a Windows 10 box, and that'll probably last a while. It's, you know, we bought her a pretty inexpensive
one. Yeah.
Windows will last forever now for the most part. I mean, you can, as long as the box holds up, I'm just not sure today there's a reason to upgrade for most people. But yeah, maybe the next box is a
Chrome. Yeah. Well, this R11 model is a good fit. It seems durable. It's lightweight.
Same price as
the R11 is like 300, under 300.
Okay.
But the Lenovo, they make some good Chromebooks too. They're a little more durable and rugged. One of the models we have has a camera that rotates forward and back. So it can face you or you can turn it around, which is kind of a nice feature.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of good choices.
Yeah. I'm at work and we're a Windows shop. And so it makes no sense. I've even taken my own equipment to work and I never get a chance to use it because I need to be on my work issued equipment. We could, but I've taken my Surface Pro 3 to have kind of as a backup and I've tried using it. And man, my work laptop is just really good, right? So at work, I'm on that all the time.
Good job to your IT crew.
Yes.
They make you want to use their device.
Right on. And it just works great. It's Core i5. It's got 8 gig of RAM. I never owned a little SSD in there. It's the right size screen. It's light. It's a Dell. It just does its, and I've broken a USB port, but it just does its job. So at work, like, okay, I don't need to bring my own equipment. I use the iPhone. I come home and I've got a desk full. If you could just kind of see you guys can't see the cam from the camera here, but I got I have the Windows RT tablet sitting in front of me. I got a Surface Pro 3 over here. I've got a little Dell mini computer that sits here that I run the updates on. I've got the micro server, you know, kind of sitting there that we're going to talk about why I have that there here in just a second. But so having another Chrome device to me is like, man, I don't know if I'd ever use that thing, you know, and that's what's always stopped me from buying one.
You would keep it upstairs.
Yeah, well, I have upstairs Windows PC in the kitchen, right? We bought that. I bought that big 22-inch touchscreen. Yeah,
take the Chromebook out on the porch. Yeah.
The cigar smoking one. So you go on you go out on the back deck, smoke a cigar.
Yep. Yeah. No. I mean, it's just a cheap, easy laptop.
Yeah.
You know, and and it's great for our education purpose. It's been a good fit. You know, we have iPads, but it's just. We try to keep that in the lower grades where the touch interaction, they don't need a keyboard as much. You know, it's good. But okay, so I have to share a new toy I got.
Yeah.
I have been a huge fan, I'm going to jump topics here, of the Logitech Anywhere MX mouse. So I don't know if other people use this, but it's the Logitech mouse that works on glass or shiny objects. And I have like four of these. So I have one in my bag and I have one upstairs and one downstairs and one for, I even have like paired them to laptops. So I love the Logic Anywhere MX.
And does it have that universal dongle? Does it use that one?
It's got the unifying dongle. So I think I have four that I can count. One of them died. It just died. Put in new batteries. It blinks orange and red. It's never happened. It died. So I thought, well, that's pretty good. I don't know how many years I've had it. So I ordered the MX Anywhere 2 refurbished from Amazon. It is awesome. So it's got the same weight, the same form factor, a lot of the same features. But what it adds is it has Bluetooth or dongle. So you can use a dongle just like all the others, or you can use Bluetooth, and you can pair it with multiple computers. So you have a little button that you can choose 1, 2, or 3, and I pair it with the Chromebook as 1, and then I paired it with my work laptop, Windows laptop as 2, so I can switch back and forth without having to move the dongle. And it has a rechargeable battery instead of double A's, but...
So it has a dock that you put it on then?
No, it's just a little USB
mini
micro front. Yeah. Like some of the other Logitechs. But it's got the good scroll wheel that I like. It's the weight. So this is my new, and it's almost identical to the old one. I mean, it's a little different looking, but the same size.
You like that size? You like that form factor for your hand?
Yeah. I mean, at my desk at work, I have one of the large Logitech's, the fuller one, because if I'm working all day, I like a little bigger, but in my bag and everywhere else, this is worth it to me. And it is a little more expensive than your super cheap ones, but big fan. And the MX2, adding the Bluetooth or dongle and the multiple computer setup is just awesome.
Yeah, 50 for that now. I think you can get the original MXs are 30 on Amazon. I use Logitech, pretty standard.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
This is just a workhorse. This is the one that sits on the desk. But I have three other mice. Actually, one I just retired because I put the Surface on here. But this is a Microsoft, a little Microsoft mouse. It's got
they call it the Blue Laser?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Been just a workhorse. Actually feels really good in your hand. Feels solid, and it's small, so it travels well. You can pull that dongle out. That's actually how I broke my laptop, one of the USB ports. I had this dongle in there.
Yeah.
And it was the backpack before it. I've got a little sleeve in there now, so when I put it in, it's got a little, it catches it, right? Keeps it from smacking the ground. And the old one hit the ground with the dongle in it and just shattered the dongle. And, of course, it broke the USB port. In the process. Well,
this one has the Bluetooth, which usually has been unreliable for me. I've tried Bluetooth mice before and you always have pairing issues, but so far so good. I haven't had a problem. The only thing I don't like is that the MX1 had a large slider switch for turning it on and off. So you just slide it off when you throw it in your bag, so it's not running battery. And this one has a really small fingernail switch, which is a little more work, but otherwise, I've been really happy with it. Good find.
And a little hard to remember sometimes.
Yeah, $22 refurb on Amazon, so you can get it cheaper.
Oh, so 50 new, but you got it for $22. Nice. Yeah.
So worked fine. That's a big win.
Okay.
Oh, no, wait. That's the first generation.
Yeah, it's $21.95. Yep, that's the MX Cert. I don't know if that's a pretty new mouse. They may not have refurbs yet.
Well, mine was.
Maybe. Oh, was it?
Okay. Yeah. So maybe they ran out.
Might have to dig a little bit to get. I think mice are great. Those are great to get on refurb. Like if you some things you don't like a motherboard, I don't know if you want to buy.
Well, I'm sure it just sat on a display somewhere and people picked it up and looked at it and put it down. And
yeah, it might have even in the manufacturing process, something was off.
Yeah.
Something didn't get seated just right and it had to come off the assembly line. Somebody had to fix it. And of course, once that gets touched in that way, it has to be sold as refurbished.
Yep.
So it could be as easy as that. It also could be oftentimes they have a bad part that they've put in a bunch of them before they figure it out.
Oh,
and then
sure.
So they pull them off the production line. They get, China, they get somebody to swap them out and then they sell them as refurbs. And it's a great way to get it done. Well, that's pretty cool. Mice are one of those things. We have not, you don't do a whole show on mice, but they are super important parts of what we do, I think, especially in the enterprise. And yeah, a lot of things are going touch, but there are still some things that I do, and I'm sure there's some things that you do where it's helpful to have a very accurate mouse to kind of get the work done. So pretty cool. A recommendation on those, Nathaniel. Hey, I want to jump to CrashPlan because we had alluded to maybe some Apple talk, but actually I think we can probably wrap up the show with what's going on with CrashPlan. And it's crazy. This was 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's crazy. We haven't talked about it hardly at all on this show. And Dave McCabe covered it. If you listen to Reset, Dave covered it right as it was happening. And so by now, I don't know if we need to kind of cover the basics because most people know what's going on. If you're a CrashPlan customer, they have decided to get out of the consumer business. I think it's that simple. And they have said, hey, we are not going to allow anyone to re-sign up. Nathaniel, you and I are in exactly the same boat, by the way.
Yep.
We're not going to allow anybody to sign up. You and I just had. So we snuck in under the wire and had a whole year's worth of stuff. They have said you get an extra 2 months, so whatever you had plus two, so for us, 14 months, so to speak, before they get out of it. No new signups. And if you're going to stay on, you have to move to their business plan. And by the way, their business plan is $10 a month. In effect, it doubled the price of storage, and it's only up to 5 terabytes. I think
$10 a month per device.
Right, per device, yes. So if you had multiple devices... Yeah, it gets expensive. Yeah, boom. Now, I was running off my Drobo. It's not going to work off the Drobo, so I had to do something different. But it really didn't sit well with a lot of people. I mean, I was, if you're over in the Home Server Show forums, there we had a little bit of a thread at the averageguy.tv Facebook group, but man, there was some blistering going on in the Home Server Show forums. Nathaniel, talk a little bit about your setup. I mentioned you had just purchased, you know, you're going to get some extended time on it, but how do you have things set up? How much storage did you have over there? And let's kind of walk through what some of our options are.
Yeah. So this was a surprise to me too, when they sent out that email.
Yeah, everybody.
Cause I was always under the impression that they use their consumers to sort of beta test and kind of get a feel for things. And then they roll it up into enterprise. And I think they flipped that model, where enterprise is their number one focus. And they've really tried to, I think, position themselves more of a security company, not just a backup company. So we're going to protect and index your data and, you know, data loss prevention in addition to backing it up. So, and I think that's fine. It was just kind of, whoa, a surprise for everyone. So immediately I started getting emails from friends and family saying, well, what do you want me to do? Because I had positioned myself as a backup target for so many friends and family, and I will build the servers, do the storage. They can just back up to me for free using the client. And I don't even know how much terabytes of data I'm storing for people, but they're all like, what now? And so, I don't know. I just told them I don't have an answer yet.
You have a server. You don't know exactly how much you're storing for them. Give us a guess. What do you think? How big is that server that you're using?
Most of it's on a Windows Home server.
Okay.
So at the 2011 server where I'm using DrivePool.
Yep.
And so most of it's there. Then I have some on a Mac Mini. But I would guess, I don't know, I'd have to log in to look, but probably 6 terabytes.
Okay. So quite a bit.
Other people's stuff.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But it's part of the fun. You know, you build the rig, you use DrivePool, you grow it, you monitor it. And, you know, it's for me, it's like, please don't bring me your laptop and tell me you don't have a backup.
Right.
So right. That's how I used it. And I appreciate that. So I don't have a good answer yet. I don't know. I've got a year.
Well, let's talk about your setup really quick.
Yeah.
So you've got 6 computers that you're paying for. Were you on the family plan?
I'm on the family plan. I back up to my own computers. I back up to a friend and I back up to CrashPlan Central, their cloud.
Yeah.
I have 6 computer clients running the program. It's 3 Windows, 3 Mac. And all total, I have 1.2 terabytes of data that they are storing. So I logged into my account and I looked like, oh, 300 gigs here, 600 gigs there. Most of it is music and photos. So my music library gets backed up, all my photos, and then data, you know, documents, probably a lot of miscellaneous stuff I don't really need. And I guarantee there's some duplicates across computers as I've migrated from an older iMac to a new Mac Mini or to a new Windows desktop. So there's if you put it all together, there'd be a lot of duplication. So 1.2 terabytes of data up there. I could definitely take some time to pare it down under 1 terabyte. So as I'm looking at options, I'm saying, okay, let's just predict that I have 1 terabyte of online storage to pay for. I don't have DVD rips. I don't have TV recordings from Media Center. I do have home videos and home movies.
No, and you should.
That's valid.
It's legit. Yeah, no, right on.
Yeah. And
did you listen to the reset episode that Dave did?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he was pretty hard. I sense a little defensiveness in that. No. I didn't have rips. I don't, because he was pretty hard on.
Yeah. Well, community. And then some people do that, you know, and yeah. I've always taken the attitude of the others of like, I have the physical disc. If I lost all these rips, I could just rip them again, you know, and yeah. I could probably do the same with music. I'm just lazy, you know, and reality is the music isn't as important digitally anymore because I either have the disc or I can subscribe to Google Music or Spotify. So the music's even less important. So I could pare it down. I could definitely go under 1 terabyte and I could probably do less if I wanted to put effort into it. But one of the things I loved about CrashPlan was the peer-to-peer backup, whether it's in your house or to a friend, you know, that was unique. And as far as I know, there's not another tool like that. And if I'm wrong and somebody, you know, knows some, let's talk. Cause you know, someone said, well, what about BitTorrent Sync, which now has a new name like Resilio or something, but Sync's not backup and Dropbox is not backup. You know, and Google Drive is not backup. So I'm not looking for that kind of tool where I want this data duplicated across devices. So, you know, I have 17 people backing up to me, and I don't really have a good answer for them other than, well, you've got a year. It's not till October 2018. It's still going to work for a year. It's fine. We got time. But what's been fun is so many other vendors have jumped on this and said, hey, are you a CrashPlan user? Come look at our product, and here's how we compare. And CrashPlan, the company, Code 42, did partner with Carbonite to offer a discount if people wanted to switch to Carbonite. You know, since I kind of grew up on CrashPlan, I have this aversion to Carbonite and Mosey because they were big competitors. And so it's kind of funny that they're like, oh, just go to our friends Carbonite over here. And there's limits to how Carbonite works. You know, it doesn't do external drives. It has limitations on versioning and things like that. You know, it's a good tool. It definitely, you know, people can use it and get what they want out of it. It just wasn't right for me. And so I'm not looking at that. So a couple paths you can take in a household like mine, where you have multiple devices and you have this management of IT idea. And that's, you can try to centralize your data into one place, like a NAS or a server. And you can try to either backup clients to a NAS, or you can try to say, I'm going to store all my pictures on the NAS, I'm going to store all my videos, and I'm going to centralize the stuff I care about in one place and then back that up. So that would be your Synology, your Unraid, your QNAP, your Windows Home Server. I'm putting my data in one basket, and then that gets backed up offsite. So that's one path I could go. I haven't really worked that way a lot because I've been using CrashPlan, which is more distributed model of each client backs up on its own. And by the way, their emails that they've been sending lately about your device status, about which one's backed up or not, terrible. It's so hard to read. I like the old emails better, but it's going away. Whatever. I just get picky.
No, I think it's fair. Mike has been, you know, Mike Howard in our chat room, you know, he was in a situation. We're fortunate we had paid for a year, so those things will stay around for you there. Although I've already ditched it. I'll talk about that here in just a second.
Yeah.
But he was mentioning that he has more than 5 terabytes, and there is a 5 terabyte limit. And migrating is not an option with 5. They're going to delete him. And so, like, 5 terabytes takes a long time for a lot of people to get there. Or in Mike's case, Mike, I don't know how many you have total. I know it's a lot. You know, that's just not something you do over the weekend. I've been doing some backups. I've been doing some re-backups because I made a mistake. And it takes, you know, I'm in the days. I'm in the 8 or 9 or 10 days. And I've been kind of doing it sporadically to get it up there. But it takes a while. So there were some other things that caught people really off guard, and where it was like, hey, if you were coming to the end of your subscription, you got the 2 months additional, but you got to make a decision right now. Right?
Yeah. So that's a good point, because I haven't really considered that. I keep thinking, oh, I've got a year. But if you want to get that big data out of CrashPlan, and especially the files that you've unknowingly deleted from your desktop, right? So when you restore, you want to be able to say, I want to restore the files that I deleted, because I may not have them anymore to re-back up because I didn't know I deleted them, right? So it's Dave McCabe's Mr. Backup episode of,
right.
I didn't realize I hadn't backed up, or I deleted the originals, but I don't have the backup archive anymore. So, what is it? Backblaze does a nice job of saying, here's how you move from CrashPlan to Backblaze with your deleted files and things. And they walk you through it. Just really nice, smart of them to do that. But that's a good point, that if you've got a lot of data, you've got to start planning now how to get it out and to back it up again somewhere else. And yeah, that's a challenge he's got ahead of him.
Yeah. And if you feel like your data at home is accurate, and you can kind of wipe out the versioning that you had on the backup stuff, but there's a risk. There's a risk associated with it. You could, you know, you could go out and back and download your entire, you know, go pick up another drive or whatever and download your entire, it depends on, some of us have caps. I mean, there's a lot of headache in this, but you could download your entire restore set. Then that's as good as having it at that point, and then make some decisions about what you're going to do with it. Archive it off, keep it somewhere. Because for some of us, it's going to take a month or two or maybe three to get back into having everything up there and making sure it's kind of where you want it. You mentioned Backblaze, which I think is probably going to be the leader on this. I think they're going to probably benefit the most. Backblaze has both a consumer plan and a B2 plan that has an open API, and there's some stuff that integrates in with it. Backblaze is offering some great deals on this, and I think they're unlimited, right, at this point, or do they have a cap as well? Do you know?
I think they're unlimited because for Backblaze B2, it's like Amazon S3, you pay as you go.
You pay as you go. Right?
So I haven't done the math. So like in the case of Mike, where he's got 5+ terabytes, I would not, it depends on the device count. So if you go with one of those plans where you pay $60 for a device for a year, but then unlimited backup, if you can get the backup out and to it, maybe that's economical. Or you go to the pay for what you use storage plan, and like Backblaze is 0.005 cents a gigabyte, but even, 5 terabytes would be what, $300 a year or something. So it gets expensive. Yeah. And so part of it is like, I look at the different options, like, okay, which one's going to be the cheapest, where I'm going to save money. And they're like, wait a minute, $300 a year for backup seems really expensive because we've been used to crash plan, which has been 120 or, whatever around that a year for unlimited. But then, $300, you know, maybe it's worth it.
Yeah. I think you've got to make that decision, and you're going to have to look at those various certain, I get real hesitant on even as Dave was talking about this, he was very, very careful not to necessarily suggest because everybody's backup footprint is like a fingerprint.
Yeah.
It's different. It's different for everybody. And we all have different needs and different plans. What I did, so it came out and the Crash Plan was offering a 75% discount on their business plans if you purchase. I don't know how long that's going for, but if you made the migration and bought their business plan, you could get it for basically $250 a month for the next year. So that would give me 2 years of it. I had already been kind of a single backup guy. Everything was going to the Drobo. If I wanted to, and I have a different footprint where I back up the local PCs locally to using Acronis. So Acronis backs up local copies to the Drobo. And then I was using the Drobo to push everything up to Crash Plan.
Yeah.
And we also, we operate a little bit here at the Collison House like a business. If it's on your desktop, it's not technically backed up. You have to have it on the network. I say, if you want it saved, it needs to be on the Drobo. And I create linked folders and all those other things. And to this point, it's just Sarah and I. So it's just her computer and she knows better. But I have a local backup in case I need to restore. By the way, Acronis just kicks on local backup. I haven't found anything better if you're going to do it that way. Their cloud plans are a little pricey, so I wouldn't go that way. So then I turned the server, I have this little micro server. I turned that into a Windows 10 box, shared the, and then I used a stable bit drive pool to pool those together, which works great.
Yep.
I bought another copy of it. So I own two copies of it now. And then moved the Crash Plan, put the Crash Plan business, I think it's Crash Plan Pro on that box and began the migration. Now, this is where I screwed up. I really thought I had it figured out where I was going to associate, you can adopt one backup with the other. And what I didn't do is dig deep enough down and I associate it. You get one shot at this, but I didn't do it right. I didn't associate it with the new drives. I associated it with it created some kind of like, they're not ghost drives or phantom drives, but it created the old drives as it saw them.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, yeah, put them there, thinking those were the new ones. And then and then it was finished in like 15 seconds. And I'm like, what?
And yeah, kind of did like a shadow copy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm like, crap. Now, I only have a terabyte. I'm like you, 1.3. That's not for me. That's a month or two of work, just kind of making sure I'm staying under my caps. And I can get that up there pretty easily. I was a little disgruntled with myself that I actually screwed that up. But over the next month, I'll be backing those things up to Crash Plan Pro. And I feel like at least for me right now, that gets me 2 years at at way less than I was paying before, and gives me some more time to think about it. It also sets me up nicely to move, because I'm on one server now, again, and it's a Windows server. It sets me up really nicely to move to any of these services when I'm done. If I don't want to pay the $10 a month to have one device on there, I won't. I can move to, now I'm going to have to move that data again. There's nobody that's moving cloud to cloud, right?
Right. Not because, here's the deal. Like if you're structured in a way, like it sounds like you are, where your client computers are backing up to the central location.
Yep.
But then if they're backing up there, it's not flat files, is it? Isn't it a proprietary?
It's a DAT file. Yeah.
So how are you going to restore that? So if you lose your DAT file, right? And that's what you have CrashPlan for. You restore that file. How long is it going to take you to get that file decoded so that you can actually get your files out back to the client?
Well, in this case, this is where Acronis is really, really good. So it also stores a copy of Acronis. But if you don't need that, you can bring the new computer up, get Acronis on there, point it to the box where it's at. Acronis does a better job of backing up to network drives than anything I've ever seen. I mean, it's kind of like CrashPlan was, as being able to share it between computers. Now, right. I can't go outside the network, right? But inside the network, man, Acronis is just rock solid. Those guys really got it going internally really well. And then I just grab that file and bring it in. What I'm not protected against at the moment is the complete disaster. If my house gets wiped out, I lose those computers, I'm going to lose those local backups. I know they're just not going to be there. I don't move those local backups anywhere. I have thought about cloning those backups and moving them offsite somewhere. I could do that. They're pretty large. They're versioned. You know, I could do that though, Nathaniel. I could take one of those and put it on OneDrive. And then I could pull that back down later off OneDrive, put it in a place I could get to it and restore it. It's manual, right? And it's just, right? And they get pretty big because they're pretty versioned. And, you know, and that's just one of those things. I mean, a 300 gig backup can grow to, 600, 700, 800, 900 gig with versions, depending on how you're versioning it. And, but that's what I want, right? And at the local level, I want those to be highly versioned so that if there's something I want to go back to 3 days ago or 5 days ago or 2 weeks ago, it's there for me. It's just those files get pretty big. I mean, I had some pretty big, I was over a terabyte for my own server here, because in my scenario, I make this show, I put these large video files, Acronis backs them up, but because they're versioned, it doesn't really get rid of them until 6 months or a year later, because they're buried in my backups as a version.
Yeah, I don't know. It's difficult, and everybody's got their own situation and take on it, depending on how they use things. So, you know, with six computers, I have stuff scattered everywhere. So to try to centralize it, it would take some effort to realize, okay, I'm only going to keep my picture library on this one because I know it gets backed up here, and everything else I don't care about. You know, we're building this giant digital hoard of data that we somehow think is going to be super valuable down the road. And like the photos and the videos are, but somehow, it's tricky.
Yeah. Which I actually think, to be honest, you're better off with, especially with our phones, you're better off pushing your pictures into OneDrive or Google Drive or Amazon. And Amazon recently wiped out their unlimited photos.
Yeah.
So pay a little bit there, but all of those phones have some automatic upload. You take the picture and voop, shoots up there. Right.
Yeah. But what's going to happen a few years down the road when my Google Photos library gets so big that I'm like, I'm having to clean this out and it's so much work.
But you're going to have the same problem if they're local, right? It's big. You're going to, what do you do with it? Right.
I need some sort of tool to index it. At least Google Photos does a good job of trying to predict and organize.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So here's what I'm thinking. I've got some scenarios that I run through and I'm looking at, and have no decision made, but I just want to kind of go over some things that I've been looking at and thinking about for our listeners that have been doing a lot too. I'm focusing, like I'm talking about my situation here. So I don't care about bare metal restore. I don't need Acronis or Veeam or some other tool to do a snapshot. None of my computers are business critical.
Right.
So if one craps out for whatever reason, I can reinstall as long as I can put my data back. I can reinstall the programs, the OS and all that. So that's not my concern. It's the data files I'm concerned about. So Synology is an appeal. I don't have a Synology. I've been using Unraid and I like that. It's 90% just Plex server storage, but I could use that as a document repository. I could do that as a picture repository. I mean, and combined with Plex, you can really take advantage of that. And I know it's redundant in the house, but nothing on that Unraid is backed up outside. So I'm not using it as a critical storage. You can install Docker apps. So they have a Cloudberry client and others where you can take your data on the Unraid and back it up offsite, because it's a pretty nice tool. I've not got into that because I haven't had a need to. But if I needed to, I would go with something like a Synology or an Unraid and central storage it, right? And then I would have to be careful about making sure the data that I care about is put there, and then that's backed up. Now, Synology, I've been reading about, has a tool called Hyper Backup, which is new in version 6. And Hyper Backup allows you to back up Synology to Synology, and you select the folders in Synology that you want to back up. It doesn't have to be all of them. And you choose how you want it to schedule, versioning, all that kind of stuff. And you can back up Synology device to Synology. They don't even have to be the same models. So you could buy a newer one with a faster processor and then buy an old one that just has a bunch of storage. And what you can do, though, my understanding is you can take that second Synology and move it offsite. So you can put it at a friend's house or somewhere else. You'd have to know the IP address or the DNS, dying DNS of the remote site, but it could pipe over the internet. So there's your offsite. I control the data backup. So if I were to put a second Synology in my friend's house, I can seed it at the house, get 90% of the backup done in my house, put it at his house, and then it's just the incrementals going over. So it's the most similar to CrashPlan that I've found so far. But it depends on me getting the data I care about onto the Synology. So can I get my picture library on there? Can I get my photo library and music and videos? It's a potential. And then they have a different tool called the Hyper Backup Vault so that you can browse your backup archive, because it's a proprietary catalog, just like Acronis, where it's a big DAT file or something. So you're not going to have browsing around what's in the backup archive. It's compressed and encrypted. You can encrypt over the internet, so you don't have to worry about security there. So going across is fine. That's one way to do it. And I know Synology also has Windows and Mac backup clients that you'd put on your local device. So I could run my Windows computer with a Synology backup tool that would capture that stuff. And then maybe those backups would get passed to the second site. It's an option to look at. I haven't done a lot with it because I'd have to buy a Synology and then I have to buy another one and then to buy the drives from. So it's a pretty big upfront investment, but maybe long-term, it's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have to think about this though. $120 is what we're talking about for even worst case scenario with CrashPlan. We're talking $120. That's a 4 terabyte. It's 1 4-terabyte drive right now, not systems, right? You know, you're talking, what you just talked about is $1,000 deal.
Yeah.
You can buy a lot of hard drives. I mean, you can buy a lot of storage for that kind of money, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like we had a pool and every year it cost me $500 or $600 to put chemicals in these pools. I could have bought a lot of pool passes for $500. Now, not as convenient because I have to drive the kids down to the pool and all those other things. But that being said, so I think we have to be careful. Like, now here's the deal. We're hardware guys. Like, if you're listening to the show, chances are you're a hardware guy. You came over from Home Server Show. You've been hanging around a while. This is what you do. So we always start thinking of our own stuff. And by the way, the average consumer isn't even thinking about this stuff. Unfortunately.
No, they don't.
They're not. No, they're not.
That's why, you know, I'm saying, like, I'm thinking about my situation. So that's one. Yeah. If I had a Synology already, then it might be like, well, it's just an incremental cost. But yeah, if I were to concentrate all my data on the Unraid or Windows Home Server or just a Windows 10 client like you're doing, and then I pay one client to back up to CrashPlan or Backblaze or whatever, you know, that's an appealing way to go. So that's sort of one scenario I'm looking at. I don't know if it makes sense. I've never used a Synology. It's got a lot of appeal because of the simplicity. I like the idea of moving to a simple appliance instead of building out an Unraid server and then cards and SATA ports and swapping drives and expanding. I like doing that stuff, but I also sometimes think, I should simplify.
Yeah.
But if we were going to move to per computer backup products, similar to the CrashPlan model where you got several clients. There's a few I've been looking at. SpiderOak 1 isn't as common in the people talking about it, but it has a lot of appeal because it's a product that is encrypted before it goes out. So they don't see your data. You get unlimited devices. You're only paying for the storage you use and your account. And then the devices that you have doesn't matter. So you have one account and unlimited devices, and you just pay for the storage. So with them, I was looking at it, is you get a terabyte would cost you about $129 annually. So that's very similar, very reasonable, very similar cost and model as CrashPlan. What it doesn't do is local backup device to device, as far as I know, and it doesn't do peer-to-peer, but it gets your data off. So it meets that goal. One of the nice things they do is SpiderOak not only does a backup profile, I want my desktop, my documents, my pictures backed up, but it'll let you set up what they call a Hive folder or a sync folder. So you can basically build your own Dropbox and create a folder that you sync across your devices or mobile that goes through their cloud, but it's encrypted and not like Dropbox where you don't know how secure or not secure it is. So it's kind of a nice add-on capability of that product, SpiderOak 1. And they have a business tool and things, but you know, this is what I was looking at. The next one is Backblaze, which you mentioned is going to be very popular. They've done a good job of putting themselves out there as a alternative to CrashPlan. One thing that's nice about Backblaze is you can select external drives. So if you have not just your internal drives, but you can select external ones to be backed up, you can do two-factor authentication with Backblaze, which is a really interesting security model, you know, protecting your data. And that's $50 a year per computer. So then that starts to get more expensive when you're paying per device. So whether you decide to back up all six devices or just the one or two, you know, you can kind of gauge it there, but then the backup is unlimited. They do have a groups plan, and they have, as you mentioned earlier, a B2 storage plan, which is like an Amazon S3. And you can use backup clients to back up to their B2 storage for a little bit less.
We had Morrow Data on here a couple weeks ago. And, you know, they have that box. They have a $400, $500 NAS, right? And they just built in B2 integration for Backblaze, which is super cheap. So instead of using S3, which is what comes standard with the plan, you pay them $10 a month. And then they, you know, this got me thinking, like, I need to rethink this Morrow Data thing, because this could be a real, you know, $500 box, less complicated than Synology, for sure. You got 1 terabyte cached, and everything is then moving automatically for you into B2. And, you pay for what you have, and it's probably not the best plan for Mike Howard, who has 7 terabytes. But for most of us who have a terabyte and want it backed up, that may not be a bad option either. But as I look at, it's funny, I'm at Backblaze right now. They say, like, welcome, CrashPlan leavers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, right on their site. CrashPlan home backup is gone. Learn how Backblaze stacks up is what they have.
Oh, yeah.
And I would seriously look at their $50 plans, because I've consolidated down to one computer now.
Right.
Really, I would consider, you know, their $50 plan. It's, and they're, you know, here's the deal though, before we cover the rest of them, all of them, you know, somebody has to pay for all this. And so as people are moving and they're dropping their prices, they're going to run into the same problem that CrashPlan ran into, is someone at the end of the day, it's going to hit the bottom line and they're going to be like, guys, we're losing money on this thing.
Right. You right. Know? And you kind of have to think, well, if CrashPlan couldn't sustain a home model, what makes these other guys think they can?
Right. Right. Yeah, right. They'll all tell you business, but then they get down the road and they're like, man, this business stuff is pretty profitable.
Like, well,
we're getting screwed on the home stuff, because they all do. You get all these unlimited plans, get everybody to try and jam everything in there, you know, to get all this stuff, and that's not profitable for them. It's enormous. It's an enormous cost for them. So Mike's 7 terabytes represent about 20 terabytes on the backside to keep track of all that, right? That's a lot of storage. Depending on how much versioning you got turned on there, that thing could be gigantic. So you start looking at that, and you know, from a business perspective, and I'm not saying it's wrong. They said it was okay, right? They sold it this way. Mike took advantage of it. It's what he should have done, but it's just not sustainable. We should be very, very careful as we're picking these backup providers that were, you know, just because it's the cheapest doesn't mean they're going to be around the longest.
Well, and I think that's really important now, because we've all put a lot of trust in CrashPlan, and it's not that they're untrustworthy, it's they change their mind on us. So yeah, whether we were naive to think we could just do this forever and not have to worry about it, or, you know, they changed their mind and decided we home users weren't important, I don't know. But I think his point is, he's brought up, you know, I need to trust a company that's there for the long haul. And so my question would be, then do you look at a model that says you have to do it yourself, find a way to do Synology or Unraid or your own servers deduplicated on your own thing? Or do you say, I'm going to invest in a model that says pay for what you use so that we can sustain backing up your data? So whether it's some sort of client tool, and then you pay for the storage that you store, whether it's a B2 or Amazon or Azure. And then you say, I'm paying for this client tool that I like to use and separately for the storage, so that I feel like I'm paying for what I get and I'm not averaging. So I'm sure CrashPlan and the other companies use a lot of actuarial type predictions of what do we need to charge to cover most users. Right. So most users are not going to go over 400 gigabytes or something like that. And we got some that are 7 terabytes, but we got a lot that are 50 megabytes. You know, they don't know what they're doing and they're just paying the same amount. So I'm sure at some point those tables turned and they said it's not profitable.
Right. Yeah. No, Mike had mentioned in the chat room, and I remember when he had this conversation, he visited their data center or one of their sites, and he told them what he was doing. Like, that's perfectly fine. Like, in there, you know, they were trying to gain market share. And so they were just telling everybody, yeah, this is great. Do it. Yeah. We challenge you to, we're good at this. And then that model matured. And at one point they're like, we're not good with this anymore. You know, somebody started looking at the bottom line and kind of saying, you know what, this is draining us. And we need to, you know, make a change. It always goes that way. Quickly here, because we're going to run out of time, Nathaniel. Yep. This always goes so super fast. And Nathaniel has some of the best show notes I've ever seen, to be honest with you. And I know I've said that before, but I really mean it actually this time. Nathaniel, you looked and kind of reviewed. This is kind of like my cloud storage guide that I have. If you on the site, you know, a couple years ago, I built this cloud storage guide, and a lot of them are the ones that you've listed here. CloudBerry, you have to think about Google. You know, you could stay on. We talked about staying on the CrashPlan Pro. They're giving a $75 or 75% discount right now. There's OneDrive. I've seen a 5 terabyte Office 365 plan. So you buy this plan and they give you 5 terabytes instead of just the one. I've seen that. I need to track it down to see where that link is, but I know it's available. You could get up to 5 terabytes on OneDrive if you want to do it that way. Now, it's not always backup, and so most of the time it's sync, and it's not always backup, and you need to know the difference between the two and make sure you've got that set that way, right? Really, really important. Those are two different things in backup. If you're syncing the file, you're not backing it up. It's just a copy of what you have, and you have to make sure it's being versioned. So that's super important. Any other things you want to mention in there?
Yeah. So the other ones that I looked at, so Spider Oak One and Backblaze are good. And Arc Backup, ARQ, by I think it's Haystack Software, is a really appealing tool. It's a very well-designed backup client for Windows and Mac. And I haven't been using it, but I know it's gotten very good reviews for restore authenticity. So especially on the Mac, and it started out as a Mac-only client, where there's a lot of metadata around your files, Arc Backup has been known for being very precise about putting that metadata back in place. It doesn't strip out permissions. It doesn't strip out any of the Mac files are sometimes packages with files in them. So I know if you're a big Mac household, that's one to look at. And that's a account-based software. So you pay for an account, $50 an account, and then you pay for your storage somewhere else. So like CloudBerry, it's like you buy our software. I don't care where you put your data. You can go here, there, everywhere. Just we're focusing on developing the good software and the integration. then how much you want to store is up to you. And so that looks like an appealing product. It has the usual destinations. So I'd look at that. Cloudberry has been very well known for a while, especially because it has server client versions. And it's a similar model of pay for the client, pay for the backup somewhere else. But they're a per device cost. So unless you consolidate your data, you're going to pay for every computer that you're backing up. And you pay for storage. They do have a free version, but it doesn't have quite all the same features. I haven't tried that, but I know it's respected. I think it's encryption and compression that get added to the client if you pay for Cloudberry. So if you only have a small amount, Grandma, I'd have to set it up for you and, you know, create your account at Amazon and do that. But it could be close to free for her. Google Drive, I didn't really think of this until recently, but Google Drive has a new tool called Backup and Sync, which is different from their Google Drive syncing tool, which is basically Dropbox for your Google Drive. But Google Drive Backup and Sync allows you to take the data that's not in that Google Drive folder and back it up into your Google Drive account. So it adds that local file backup into Google Drive, and you'd see under Google Drive a My Computers tab. And so you could back up your desktop and your pictures and things. And their storage is reasonable. It's $100 a year for a terabyte. So if you wanted to use that, you could have more than one computer. You can select your pictures directory, which may be in Google Photos already, but you could use Google as a storage and the Drive Backup Sync tool. I don't like that idea for me, just because the whole point of putting stuff as Google Drive is that I don't have to keep it on my computer. But it's a very easy tool. So it might be something I recommend to friends, like, yeah, just use this tool, pay $100 a year for more storage, and then just make sure your pictures directory is selected. Crash Plan Small Business, the 75% off is only the first year.
Correct. Yeah. But so it does buy you some time.
Buys you some time. And it, some time. And if you can consolidate, I think if you consolidate your data, you have a lot of options. And that's something that I have to think about because I've never had to worry about it. But
yeah. And I was already consolidated. That was I had made that move when I moved on to the Drobo.
Yeah. So that's kind of the ones I'm looking at, what I've been doing. I haven't made up my mind, but now that you reminded me about, you have to get the data out and then get it back up somewhere else. Now I have a little more sense of urgency about this.
Yeah. And you don't have to pull it down. Like you can, if you feel like your current folders are the gospel truth, you're good. Yeah. You don't need to do anything. You're going to need to repoint them and then start to budget. If you're on a cap, start to budget where else they're going. I really do think it's worth a couple weekends of thought and bouncing it off people. And this is one of those things. There's no right way. We've said this several times. It's your way. You need to figure out, everybody's situation is different. Everybody has a different level of security and safety that they're thinking. Mike left, but he's pretty burned by this. He's really upset with them.
Well, and part of it is he has a high data need. As a photo and video guy, his files aren't small. So in some ways he's being penalized because of the type of work he does and the passions he has. Right. And my text documents don't take up a lot of space, but my home movies do. And the more I want to take VHS and convert it, it's going to grow. So I don't blame him for being upset, but
it was pretty unusual in the day to get unlimited when this started, and they came on the scene and they're like, unlimited. And everyone's like, are you sure? Oh yeah, this is great. And it's, and you're like, you feel a little burned, you're kind of like, wait a minute, you guys started this. And I know for business reasons, you're doing things differently, but then you just broke up with me. I mean, it was one day out of the blue. It was like, hey, I'm, it's not me, it's you. And literally, right? And so that's a tough pill to swallow. And I know for a lot of individuals listening, you're like, oh, crap. Like, I've got to do something. And you do. Yeah, you do. You're going to have to look and figure out it. I looked at everything to Nathaniel. I did the same thing you did. I went through all the plans, took an inventory, kind of thought through it. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to buy myself some time. I'm just going to make this migration. Screwed it up in the process. So, it's not as easy as I thought it was, but we'll get it fixed. And so for me, that was kind of that's the kind of thing. And it gives me 2 more years to kind of think about it. Yep. And I'll see where it goes.
Yeah. And it's going to shake out. So yeah. We're all going to try something different. And I'd be really curious in the Facebook group, if people read this, you know, show notes I put together and bring some of their own ideas of like, you know what, Veeam has worked really great for me. And here's why. And here's the model I'm using. I have one computer, it backs up to here, and then I do this. Or, you know, but for my friends and family, they're like a 1, maybe 2 computer household. So the client cost is not big. So what I'm looking at for them is what's going to be easy and reliable, you know? What can I say? This is easy to install. You create an account and then the rest you don't have to worry about. I'm not going to recommend to my friends to buy Arc Backup and then create an account with Amazon S3 and do this. And, you know, no. For them, it's got to be one tool, one company, one cost.
Right. You know? And you had gone beyond the level of service where you recommended that they back up to you. I thought about doing that, right? I had thought of becoming, you know, because in the day, nobody was doing it right and it was awful and we were losing files. And I'm like, screw it. You just back up to me and I'll make sure. I never had any of my kids take me up on that. We never got that set up. Now I'm kind of glad. You know, it's like,
Yeah. Well, so what do I do with their archives?
I just delete them.
I can't see anything. And I don't care to see the data, but
they got to pull them down. They need to pull them down from you. Like they need to go in there and pull those back down. Yeah.
They're going to have to come over. Like,
well, if depending on how much they have, your friends don't have a lot of data, to be honest. You had 17, right? And you have about 6 terabytes.
Oh, so now I'm curious.
You're going to have to look in there.
Dang, I didn't even think of this. Thanks a lot.
They're going to have to pull it down. That's what I would recommend is that they pull it down to a spot. Although some of them may not have a hard drive big enough to be, if they've got a lot up
versioning,
there.
Yeah. I don't know. That's good. There's some that
they don't need to worry about versioning, right? The download will wipe out all versions, right?
Yeah.
When they restore it, that wipes out all versions.
Yeah. It'll be the latest version of all the files
or whatever. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is going to continue. I'm going to have to explore how to get your restore out that includes deleted files if you want them. I've got to figure out how I can recommend to my friends or family to get their archives back out if they want. But I've got archives of computers that friends had 3 years ago.
Right.
And they've never deleted the computer from their account. So I still hold the archive. So maybe that's why I have 6 terabytes. I don't know.
And now you understand why CrashPlan made the decision they did. Right?
Those guys weren't paying them a dollar.
Can you imagine? I mean, it's not just the people who have active backups. Well, they were paying them every year. They'd pay them the $60.
No, not my friends.
Oh, right. No, right on. Yeah. They don't care. You were their IT guy.
Yep.
Well, if you're interested in keeping going on with this conversation, lots of conversation over at the Home Server Show forums. So head over there if you want. In our Facebook group, love more average guy stuff, more whatever. You can join us in the Facebook group. We can talk about that there as well if you want to do it. Whatever you want to do, however you want to get it done. I'm interested in hearing about what you've done or what you're going to do or what you're thinking about. It's a very valid point, and it put a bunch of us in a pinch. That's for sure.
Yeah, so. Well, you definitely having conversation makes me think of a lot more things that I hadn't considered.
Sorry. Sorry to bring the bad news. Yeah, here you thought you were coming on and you were going to inform some people.
I know all the answers.
And then it's like, oh, crap, I got to do some stuff. Yeah, you do. Yeah, you got to get some stuff done. Well, Nathaniel, thanks for coming on. Hang tight. If you can stay around for a little bit of post-show, we'll do that as well. We're a little long, but we appreciate a great conversation. By the way, I've been getting some great feedback over the last couple of weeks, both on Paul Brennan. So Paul was last week, came on and talked about what's going on at VMware, and man, had some dynamite equipment that we talked about last week. So got some really positive feedback on Paul and his episode with us. And then some really good feedback on Dwayne as well. And we talked about mining rigs and we talked about a bunch of PC equipment, kind of how to afford that. As we're recording this right now, it's September 14th, Bitcoin is plummeting at the moment. So, you know, you got to stay up on this kind of stuff. And I did get a little negative feedback. Some of you weren't necessarily appreciative of we'd had a couple of Bitcoin conversations in a row. Sorry about that. I'll try and spread those out a little bit, but it's hot right now. It won't be, you know, in the fall, it won't be, it'll be gone again and nobody will care. everybody will have overspent on their rigs. But we got some great feedback. If you want to give me some feedback, send me an email, jim@theaverageguy.tv. I always appreciate the feedback, both negative and positive, but I'll be honest, I love the positive way more than I love the negative. So if you want to send that over, that's great. If you want to support the show, don't forget, pre and post show now available if you're a Patreon subscriber, $1. That's all it takes to get in there, $1. And next year when we do the meetup, Patreon is going to probably be required to be to come to the meetup so I can cover some of the costs of that, or we'll probably use Patreon to get. Did I say we're going to have a meetup next year? Is that what I just said?
Nice.
Oh no. Maybe I've committed to it. Oh well, Midwest meetup of some kind. We'll try and pull that off next fall. But if you want to support us out there, head out to theaverageguy.tv and click on the Patreon link. Don't forget the AverageGuy.tv platform, both web and media hosting, powered by Maple Grove Partners. I just saw Christian. It was great hanging out with him, and he's got some great stuff going on there in Virginia. Get secure, reliable, high-speed hosting from people that you know and you trust. For more information, maplegrovepartners.com. Maybe Christian should get into some backup stuff, you know? He could do it right. If anybody was going to do it right, it'd be that Christian Johnson. So, Christian, if you're listening, he never would listen this far. Don't forget, you can catch Home Gadget Geeks on the Android and iPhone app, both available at the average or at homegadgetgeeks.com. I don't know why I keep saying the wrong address to that. The one on Android is now fixed, so if you've been waiting for that, head out there and get it. It's available for you. Thanks, LastPass, for their sponsorship, and we're trying to get that thing taken care of. Amber's going to be on here first week of November, so we'll be back at a chance. They've got some changes going on over there at LastPass. We are live every Thursday, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern. We got some great shows lined up for you as well. If you subscribe to the newsletter, you will now get a weekly update for the next four shows that you would have known Nathaniel was going to be on tonight. And so we'd love to have more people come out and join us live, but if you want to subscribe to the newsletter, and I won't spam you, maybe three sentences in there. And well, three paragraphs. Let's just say three paragraphs of information. Subscribe to the newsletter. Head out to theaverageguy.tv/subscribe. And that will get you, there's a little sign up thing. You can just sign up and get it. I won't spam you, but you'll know what's coming up in future episodes. We'll be back next week, same time, 8 o'clock. Yeah, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern at theaverageguy.tv/live. With that, we'll say goodnight, everybody. Goodnight.